Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMC ortho.
Welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. Joining us in the studio today for Medical Monday are Drs. William Andrew Wilson and John Sabia. Dr. Wilson is Director of Emergency Services at Northern Dutchess Hospital in Rhinebeck, and Dr. Sabia is Vice President of Medical Affairs. Both are practicing physicians in the emergency department. Dr. Wilson earned his medical degree at John A. Burns School of Medicine at the University of Hawaii. Tough service. He completed a residency in emergency medicine at Yale University. He's board certified by the American Board of Emergency Medicine. Dr. Sabia offered his medical degree. Earned his medical degree at the State University of New York at Buffalo School of Medicine and completed his residency and family practice at St. Clair's Hospital in Schenectady. He's board certified by the American Board of Family Physicians. Dr. Wilson, Dr. Sabia, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thanks for having us on.
Well,
thank you.
We are delighted that you're here. John and Andy, the phones are going to be lit up in a second now. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. The thing that I've always loved about emergency room guys is that they have to know everything. I mean, they have to know everything. You can't know a little. In an age of specialization, somebody comes in and says, my back, my foot, my nose, whatever. You've got to know at least most of what you need to know, right?
I would have to say the best way to sum it up, I've said, is you have to kind of be the jack of all trades, master of the emergency. And I think, you know, you do know a little bit about each subject, but we are by no way specialists of each subject. But boy, we come across everything from childbirth to heart attack to trauma victims. So it does. It's a very humbling field to be in.
So what's the number one thing that will get your attention in the emergency room? I've always thought it is you run in and you yell, chest pain.
That will certainly get you a ticket to the bedside pretty quickly. You know, there's no question chest pain is probably at the top of the list, but there's lots of other emergencies. There's traumatic emergencies that require attention right away. There's no question the presentation of a stroke patient really is very, very high on our list, and those patients need to get prompt attention. There's a few things in emergency medicine that if you treat the patient early and quickly, you have better outcomes. And
yeah.
Stroke and heart attack are probably at the top of those lists. But, you know, like Andy said, it's a wonderful field. I've been doing this for 27 years. It's a wonderful challenge. I really can't see me doing anything else with respect to clinical medicine because we're challenged every day by all kinds of different things. And 27 years and probably 120,000 ER patients into this, I still see new things in different presentations. But it's a wonderful field to practice.
Without naming names, can you guys tell me the strangest things you've ever seen in an emergency room?
Oh, boy, you want to start with this one, Andy?
I'll tell you, just a couple of weeks ago, yeah, you know, you get the people that come in and, you know, it's the stories that always kind of baffle you a little bit, you know, about the gentleman who has, without naming anything specific, but let's say he has a head laceration and he says, oh, well, you know, this or that happened in my car on the way to X and to a certain destination. And we found that in the actual parking lot, there was a deer sticking out of the front car, you know, front of the car still, you know, that kind of a thing. You know, always amazed by what you see. But there's also a lot of humbling things that happen in human tragedy. We do have a front seat to some of the worst things that you can possibly imagine. And it is frightful, the things that can happen to your loved ones.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So, you know what this show's all about, guys. We're going to get telephone calls, and you answer them, okay?
Okay.
And we'll go to Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jim. You're on.
Thanks. Question for the coming week here. How would you differentiate hypothermia from stroke other than core body temperature?
Well, certainly, you know, when people present with stroke, they usually present with clinical findings, and a lot of those findings are usually unilateral. Patients develop weakness on one side of the body, sometimes difficulty with speech. Hypothermia is more of a kind of a generalized system presentation for folks. A lot of times it's decreased mentation.
What do you say? Decreased
mentation, just not thinking as well as they should because of a hypothermia. And there's no question, you know, the history and the core body temperature really makes the diagnosis of hypothermia. And if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, so I agree. And I think, you know, it's more of a global problem with hypothermia. This is a great question, by the way, because you know what? It can be confusing. Because both can present with slurred speech, and so some of the symptoms might overlap. However, really, when you get a right-sided problem or a left-sided problem, then you know that tends to be more on a stroke type of presentation than hypothermia. And then, of course, the history, ask you know all the right questions to see what the background of this patient was.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
1-800-348-2551. Every phone is free now. By the end of this, I guarantee you every phone will not be free. If you want to ask a question of these two amazing emergency room doctors, now's the time to do it. 1-800-348-2551. So, I guess you guys know that the word of the year is Ebola.
Do you have a couple more hours?
Yeah, right.
Have time for us?
And I guess you know that at least one hospital screwed it up. And sent somebody home they shouldn't have sent home. And immediately, in emergency rooms all over the country, there are signs everywhere about, have you been in West Africa recently? Or have you been abroad? What have you learned about what you should be doing about Ebola?
We've learned a lot. There's no question about it. And I mean, whether there's a screw-up or not, I don't really know the details of that care. But I think what we've learned is, you know, we have to be very much aware that it's out there. We have to be very much aware of asking the right questions when people present themselves to the hospital. And really the most important thing is when they come to the registration desk, you need to ask them if they've had travel and not just travel outside the country, travel to those countries that were endemic for Ebola. In addition to that, you certainly have got to screen them for symptoms. If there's any question that these folks have been exposed to Ebola, you better escort them back out the door into a separate entrance, into an isolation room where they can be, you know, basically quarantined. And most important now, what really changed about Ebola preparedness, of course, you know, ER physicians and ER providers know how to take care of patients. But the part two to this was to make sure that our staff, nursing, and physicians clearly are protected when they go walk into a room to take care of an Ebola patient.
How so?
It's basically a very extensive three-layer protective gown system that they have to place on. That's done very delicately and systematically with a buddy watching the process.
And those are all ready to go now, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Anytime.
That was part of the New York State preparedness, and certainly lots of the other states prepared to take care of Ebola patients. But the big part of this was you're not just there to take care of the patient. You got to make sure that the staff is protected with these folks. And you certainly have to be prepared if one of those patients have to be admitted to your hospital. You have to have a separate segregated area to care for that patient in your intensive care unit. Lots of hours spent on Ebola preparedness. And the interesting part is, of course, we didn't really have any Ebola scares in our community, but certainly this preparedness will prepare us for something more to come. And there's going to be something more to come down the road.
So, Andy, have you ever taken a look at a patient and say, this could be it?
Well, we've had a couple of people that have actually in the screening. Screening is everything in the Ebola process, just to make sure that the demographic of patient, because, you know, fits the Ebola demographic, because so many viruses present the same way.
Sure.
So you know, Ebola is going to present a lot similar to other viruses. And so to be able to make sure the travel questions are asked. But, you know, we did have, you know, some patients that positively screened but did not have the symptoms and ruled out. But to make you feel a little better, you know, our hospital does weekly Ebola drills. I mean, every week. And, you know, Department of Health came by like they do for all the hospitals and actually surprised us with a drill with two patients, you know, that were, quote, fake patients that came by that we didn't know about. And I'll tell you, we did really well because we have been coaching this. We have a whole team that's in place really to make sure that this thing is drilled into everybody's mind. Now, I think what Dr. Sabia said was very important, which is, you know, right now this is the Ebola scare, and I just want to reassure everybody, you know, there have been a few deaths, you know, from Ebola in America, and tens of thousands of people might die from the flu this year. So just keep that into perspective. But the key also is when the Ebola scare is finished someday, this we can implement for the next avian flu. the next big epidemic that comes through. So the protocol will remain very similar with just a few tweaks here and there. So it's good for us to have this, you know, as our practicing platform.
And really, like Andy said, the screening and early basically, you know, identify and isolate, recognize these patients early on and isolate them. Because, you know, interesting enough, I know there was lots of medical information out there about Ebola, but, you know, it's not an airborne disease. So as much as we certainly try to protect ourselves from the possibility it could be, the airborne diseases are more concerning. The flu is an airborne disease. So, you know, you have to even think about those folks come to your emergency department. You know, we place a mask on them because you can transmit airborne diseases a lot easier.
We are going to take a short 7-second or so break. And Ann and Philip, you stay right there. We'll be right back to you, okay?
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing preventative heart disease screening for women at the Neil and Jane Golub Breast and Heart Center, ellismedicine.org. The Adirondack Council, over 30 years of advocacy on behalf of New York's Wilderness Park, working to protect rare wildlife and its habitat, adirondackcouncil.org. And Bassett Healthcare Network, bringing heart care to the people of Herkimer, Cobleskill, Cooperstown, Oneonta, and surrounding areas, bassett.org.
And we're back. I didn't know we were back, but we're back, thanks to Zach. All right, we'll go to Ann in Salisbury. Okay, Ann, you're on the air.
Hi, Alan.
Hi, dear.
I just want to preface my question by saying that I didn't hear the very beginning of the show and the introductions of the doctors, but from what they've been talking about, I'm assuming that they are in a much more populated urban area than the hospital that is in our small rural community in Northwest Connecticut. But so if you don't have an answer to this question, I apologize.
Well, these guys are real experts, Ann, so you don't have to worry about them. They can handle themselves, yeah.
I was wondering what the doctor's opinion is. It seems that our hospital is struggling mightily. And from what I can read in the local paper, for many years, when I first moved here, it was a nonprofit. Now it's a for-profit. And it's apparently there have been changes. I think it's the law of unintended consequences, from what I gather, that the Obamacare law that was, obviously supposed to help hospitals and citizens, is hurting our hospital. They're getting reimbursed less. I think.
Okay. Well, why don't we stop there? Because there are a lot of people behind you, Ann, and ask docs to go.
Doc. Yes, my question is, there seem to be a lot of changes. It's hard to get information that are concerning. What do you have an opinion about how
we got it.
I guess I'll take a stab at that. I know Connecticut is a little bit different than New York because we do not have for-profit hospitals in New York State. And it's a challenge. I don't really have an answer for it. I know we're kind of in a suburban area, community type hospital. We are the 68 bed hospital of a 3 healthcare system, but I think, you know, by being part of a healthcare system, that's allowed us to survive. You know, we clearly had our challenges in the late 90s being a small hospital, but when you join a larger healthcare system, I think that's really how you survive. I really think that's probably the answer. Obamacare, I think, brought, you know, it certainly made lots of patients who are uninsured insured. It helped there. But to pay for that, there were some cuts made elsewhere, and I think that's probably what you're talking about. There's no question reimbursement has suffered, and I think that really hasn't been a lot of help for the hospitals in that regard. But
yeah, I know a lot of people my age who, you know, there's no way we could live here without the hospital.
Right.
Well, I think that's probably true, right, guys, for almost every population. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't consider moving anywhere without...
Ann, how big is your hospital? How many beds is the hospital? How many beds is it? Do you know?
I don't know, but... Okay.
It's small.
It's tiny.
It's Sharon Hospital, right?
Yes, Sharon Hospital.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful hospital. My son was born there. It's just a wonderful place. And recently in the paper, they said that the emergency room... there's as a separate entity, a separate practice, and that they were replaced. The doctors were kept, but that the company was replaced by some other, maybe, you know, less expensive. It was a financial decision. And you know, these things are concerning. I just don't understand I don't understand well enough.
Well, we've established a couple of things, Anne. One is that New York State doesn't have for-profits.
Yes, I did not know that.
Yeah, okay, well, I didn't know it either. And by the way, now we know it.
Three cheers.
Yeah, and number two, that things are rough. The reimbursement rates are rough, that kind of stuff happens. But to speculate further, I think we should probably, since we don't really know the full story, leave it alone for now. Thank you so much, Anne. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan, very much.
Let's go to Philip in Kiamisha Lake. Philip, you're on.
How you doing? Yes. Okay. I was in the hospital some months ago for palpitations. I got to the emergency room. And, you know, I was thinking to myself that not everybody goes to the emergency room.
Could you speak up, Philip? It's hard to hear you.
Not everybody that goes to the emergency room is ignorant of, you know, what's going on. For example, I know I came there with very high blood pressure and palpitations. They put me on a monitor, and they said, well, you're not having a heart attack. So I was very relieved. In the meantime, my blood pressure was very, very high. And what you hear, my question is, you know, the monitor is beeping. Every once in a while it starts beeping, you know, like an alarm, like, you know, so the staff should pay attention to what's going on with the patient. Here I am with all the EKG stuff strapped onto me. And I started getting, you know, every time I heard the monitor, I think my blood pressure went up even higher because I knew that there was some kind of an alarm about my condition. And I was wondering, you know, if this is really the best way sometimes to do things when a patient is, like, strapped in there. It was very, very upsetting.
Okay, John, Philip, I'm so sorry. John, you want to answer?
Actually, let Andy take it.
So this is Andrew Wilson. I just like to say I hope you're okay, first of all. And I know it can be a daunting thing coming into the emergency department. First of all, you don't know the doctors in there. They don't know you. And that sets up a relationship where, you know, where you just feel like you're a line. You know, you're coming in a line. But I'll tell you, once you get hooked up to these monitors, we intentionally, first of all, set these monitors with a low threshold for alarming for obvious reasons. So a lot of time they alarm just simply because the sensors aren't working correctly, or it just, the sensors stop sensing for a few seconds, it'll alarm, and then the sensors will pick back up again, let's say your breathing rate or something that's not as important as, let's say, your cardiac rhythm. But you can be assured that when you're hooked up to that monitor, Philip, what happens in your room, and you know, maybe the curtain's closed and there's no nurse in there with you and the thing is going off, what is happening in your room is also being captured out in the nurse's station where you can't see the nurses monitoring them. And a lot of larger hospitals have people just with that job to monitor the monitors to make sure that it's okay, and it might be just a false alarm or a sensor. And if it is something real, you'll see people run in there. So I know, if there was a more efficient way, I'm all ears.
I was wondering what the threshold is. For example, when I went there, it turned out that I didn't have a heart attack. I was having what they call some kind of a panic attack or anxiety attack. They didn't know what it was. They couldn't figure out what it was. It took a long time for them to try to guess that it was, you know, an anxiety attack. But it turns out that my blood pressure in the meantime was, my pulse was high, but I was rapid, and my blood pressure was very high. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm lying here. My blood pressure went 190. Systole. I'm thinking, so I'm going to get a goddamn stroke while I'm in the emergency room. I got really scared about getting a stroke. I was wondering, when do they start intervening, you know, with the drug to get my blood pressure down? Why would I have to wait?
Okay. Well, let's get an answer.
That's kind of a case. This is Dr. Sabia. Kind of, you know, that's certainly case by case. You know, it's really hard to tell exactly what was going on with your situation. But, you know, there are times when emergency room physicians have to lower blood pressure aggressively when people have bleeding in their brain and people are undergoing heart attack symptoms. There are other times, you know, we'll monitor blood pressure and lots of times it'll come down on its own. And there are other times we use sedatives to bring down blood pressure, but it's kind of a case by case on basis on how aggressively we treat high blood pressure.
And Philip, this is Dr. Wilson again. You know, I just wanted to say, you know, just if you exercise and your blood pressure routinely increases astronomically, more than you'd want to know. I mean, it just happens when you exercise, your heart rate increases, your blood pressure increases. The body is designed to be able to handle, you know, acute spikes in blood pressure without having a stroke or stroke-like symptoms. A stroke is actually a lot of times caused from a clot in the system that's stopping it, not high blood pressure. High blood pressure puts you at risk for that in long term. So you're right. We don't want to keep your blood pressure at 190 for the next 6 months. But for 6 hours or 12 hours or even a day or two, it's not necessarily dangerous in every situation.
Okay, well, that's that answers that question from Philip. Thank you so much. I know you guys are incredibly worried about getting people to the ER if there are symptoms of stroke. And I wondered, Dr. Savia, whether, and Dr. Wilson, whether you would tell us a little bit about those symptoms.
Yeah, and I'll start here because I this is a topic that's kind of near and dear to my heart because, you know, the stroke patient, we need to get the stroke patients to hospitals quickly, and I think it's important for the community to understand what stroke symptoms are, as subtle as they can be, so they can get the care they need timely. We certainly have done a lot of education for the community in our area, and also for the EMS system, where we, you know, listen, if you're having symptoms of a stroke, i.e., because, you know, many times symptoms of stroke don't involve pain. Most of patients come to the emergency room because they're having some type of pain. Stroke may be just alterations in your speech, can't move your arm, can't move your leg. A lot of folks don't realize they're having a stroke. If you can get these people to the emergency department, stroke hospital, stroke designation center, which all our hospitals are stroke designation centers, you basically have a very advanced stroke team that will just care for the patient immediately. And that involves evaluation of the patient, CAT scan of the brain, and administration of a clot-busting drug, which can really stop a stroke in its tracks. That drug is time-sensitive. We really cannot administer that drug. We can actually administer that drug up to 3 hours. Now they extended the window to 4.5 hours. So the most important thing is just try to educate people what stroke symptoms can be and just come to the ER to get a quick evaluation because we can do things. After that time period, the outcomes are not as good. Disability of the patient is much higher. So to get these patients to the hospital is really the key.
Okay, very quickly then, if you will, the predominant symptoms of stroke are?
Well, there's a multitude. I mean, alterations in speech, certainly weakness of an arm or a leg.
It's typically not confusion. You know, I mean, it's not like a global problem, like people are just not making sense or they're delirious. It is the inability to actually speak, but the patient is looking you in the eyes. They can hear what you're saying. They understand what you're saying most of the time. They just can't speak it.
Can't get the words out.
And sometimes when you can't speak, that right arm also will have issues, you know, will be weaker than the left arm or left arm weaker than the right arm, depends on where the speech center is. But a lot of times there'll be multiple things affected. You know, rarely is it a global, you know, somebody just presents unconscious and it's a stroke. And like Dr. Savia said, really, it's not a painful entity. So a lot of people do delay thinking, I'll go to bed. If it's still there in the morning, I'll go to the ER. But then now you're outside of the window of treatment for some of the more aggressive treatments we have to try to decrease the disabilities.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent. 1-800-348-2551. Nancy in Belchertown. You're on, Nancy.
Hi. Thank you for having this program today. I have two quick questions. One is, what happens to blood pressure in a heart attack? Is putting a cuff on it going to give you any indication? And the second one is, how do you prefer your patients to describe their symptoms? Because my husband always says I downplay everything, and I try to pass it off lightly and the opposite of a drama queen. He said I'm not giving them the right feeling for the situation. So that's it.
I'll take the second question first, because symptoms are, you know, I mean, certainly we don't downplay anybody's symptoms. If you feel you have a problem and you need care, come to the emergency room. You're not wasting our time. That's what we do. So, you know, we want to hear in your own layman's terms what your symptoms are, and we are the professionals to sort that out. But, I mean, Andy and I feel very strong like that. Listen, everybody's welcome to come to my emergency department. Because, you know, you're not the experts. You could think it's something minor, it could be something major. And if it turns out something minor, that's okay. So you just tell us in your own words what's going on. We will ask the right questions to redirect you from time to time, and we will use keywords like, is that pressure in your chest? Is it tight? Does it hurt when you take a deep breath? Does it hurt all the time? Just a few examples of, how we sort out heart attack symptoms. But, we want to hear from you what your concerns are and we're the experts, and we kind of take it from there.
And don't be – this is Andrew Wilson. Don't be offended if we keep interrupting you a little bit to really tease out some of the specifics when you're telling your story. I know some patients get a little bit frustrated with that, but it is our job to really try to quantify how bad something is. Sometimes we use the scale from 1 to 10. Sometimes that's subjective, but it's difficult. But if you come in and try to tell a stepwise story in chronological event of what happened that brought you into that emergency department, a lot of times that is a gift for us, just so that we aren't asking a bunch of random questions that are all over the place. But most patients are really good about telling a concise story.
Great.
And time frames are important to us.
Time frames.
Yeah. Nancy, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551. What about when somebody gets shot and they get brought to the emergency room? I'm sure you've had that in the past. What are the concerns that you have then?
Well, our hospital is not a designated trauma center, but sometimes, we do wind up with self-inflicted gunshot wounds, unfortunately, or grave accidents that happen. And I have worked in trauma centers in the past, but the bullet, I'll tell you, it's pretty devastating. In basically, what you see on the outside, a small hole, only is the tip of the iceberg for everything that you got to assume happens inside the body. And there have been actually some changes with American College of Surgeons with management of, when people have low blood pressure. In the last 10 years, really a lot of development's been made in what's something called permissive hypotension, allowing the blood pressure to be a certain level that's not elevated that decreases the amount of bleeding. In addition, they actually do a lot of neuroprotective things nowadays with freezing. They actually induce hypothermia into some patients. They cool down the patient, which preserves the tissue, which decreases any sort of organ damage or necrosis due to these type of injuries. I could spend a whole hour on it, but I'll tell you, it is humbling, and things move very fast when people come in with a gunshot wound.
And how about criminals? I mean, do you ever get people who, a policeman comes in with a handcuff on somebody or something and says, this
pretty,
is...
Pretty rare at our institution, but, we try to treat all our patients the same and, provide the care that they need to. But we don't really see a lot of those folks, but treat them the same, as long as they have a solid police escort and our certain nurses are protected. That's really important to us, but we care for them like we would care for anybody else. And just getting back what Andy said about the gunshots, I think in the 27 years I've been in Northern Dutchess, I had maybe 3 or 4 gunshots, and most of them were self-inflicted. But, these are the kind of folks you got to take care of quickly and get them stabilized. Our ER doctors provide stabilization, and then they almost all go to the operating room for exploration on the gunshots.
I'm a little confused as to what that means, John, in terms of the operating room. Is there always a surgeon present at the point at which somebody comes in with a bullet in them?
Yes. Well, certainly we have a 20-minute response time of our surgeons, and a lot of them get there actually much quicker than that.
In other words, they have to be at the hospital within 20 minutes.
Within 20 minutes, but certainly some of them get there quicker. And emergency department physicians, we're certainly well-trained to provide stabilization and ongoing care till they get there.
Okay. Very good. Okay, let's go to Matt in Clifton Park. I want to give that number one more time, 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Matt, you're on.
Thank you, Dr. Shartok. And here's a question for the other doctors. I've got a dear loved one with bouts of low blood pressure that have been going on for a couple of years now, and just recently hospitalized with AFibs, and then discharged the next day. And it's kind of scary taking the AFib medicine over the next 3 bouts of AFibs we've had. They've worked. These pills work right away. But what I want to know is what you could recommend about these new devices that you could hook to your iPhone and take your own EKG to kind of be looking for AFibs. How close are we to the technology? I see them on the Internet. It's 2 points that you conduct a EKG with into your iPhone. Thank you.
I really don't know much about the technology, but I've heard that it's there Andy, yeah. Can you comment on that?
Yeah.
Okay, before you do, AFib, just so that everybody out there knows, is on the same page, aren't you?
Atrial fibrillation.
You know, there's no simple explanation. But anyway, atrial fibrillation is when the upper chambers of your heart receive the blood, the lower chambers of your heart pump the blood.
Okay.
And atrial fibrillation, when the upper chambers of your heart are just not, they're not pumping systematically and rhythmically, they're kind of pumping it erratically. Believe it or not, it's a very common arrhythmia. Probably 20-25%. I've had it myself intermittently. Mm-hmm. It can be extremely benign in young people, and it can be benign in elderly people. The issue with atrial fib, though, a complication of AFib is a possibility of stroke, because when the upper chambers are not pumping well, blood tends to be stagnant, and small clots can form. Then the clots leave the heart, and they get up in the brain. They can cause a stroke.
Yes.
That's why some patients have to be on blood thinners to prevent that from happening.
Yep. The follow-up question, please. With the bouts of low blood pressure that we've been living with, there are some pills for that take a long time to work, and usually more fluids gets the blood pressure back to normal. But then with the AFib medicine, it's supposed to be administered only if you don't have low blood pressure. As I understand it, the upper number or the lower number are more important. I need guidance on the, you know, let's say 119 over 50. Would you give the AFib medicine?
Boy, that's a question for your cardiologist.
I tell you, I don't know. There's so many medicines. I don't know which one you're talking about, because there are a bucket full of medicines that fit that. I'd hate to.
For AFib?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of different medicines for AFib.
And you're right. And some of those medicines tend to lower your blood pressure. Some don't affect blood pressure at all.
Seem like they're independent problems, but I don't believe they are. I think they're related.
Okay, Matt, thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Brandon. Doctor. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back for the last third of the program.
Support comes from Midwives of the Hudson Valley and Capital Region, offering women's health care, maternity care, and home birth services throughout the Hudson Valley and Capital Regions. Midwives support WAMC.com. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees. Offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. And the Urgent Care Centers of Middletown Medical, providing walk-in medical care with no appointment. Daytime, evening, and weekend hours in Middletown, Ellenville, and now in Chester, MiddletownMedical.com.
And we are back. There is one free phone. I'd like you to be on it. 1-800-348-2551. Before we begin, I have a question that got emailed to us at voxpop@wamc.org. Good afternoon, doctors. Have you noticed an increase in the symptom of, quote, younger patients coming into the emergency room with heart attack symptoms or stroke symptoms? Are more younger people these days suffering from heart attacks and strokes? Parenthesis, I'm curious about the connection between the fast food diet of young people and heart disease.
Well, I can start with this, and Andy can take this too, but there's no question obesity has become a risk factor for heart disease and stroke. And I think that's probably a big part of it. And we're starting to see younger folks coming in with heart disease. The other bell that goes off first when somebody comes in with a heart attack is the use of illegal street drugs, because cocaine-induced and heart attacks. Heroin has been a big problem for us recently. So, that's kind of a smaller subset of patients. I think the obesity is probably driving the onset of stroke and heart attack early in age.
Yeah, I think also that creates diabetes, which also creates additional risk factors, hypertension. There's a lot of factors. But I think this is a very intuitive question, whoever asked this, because we are seeing a little bit of a trend on the younger people as we have more processed foods and fast food diets, and obesity is increasing. We do see that, but also genetics play a big role as well. That it's one of the things that's hard to control.
Okay, all five phones are in use right now, folks. So let's go to Bob in Danbury. Okay, Bob, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. I suffer from GERD for a number of years. I've tried all the different medications to prevent GERD, Nexium, this and that. And how do I distinguish from a GERD attack and a heart attack.
You know, that's
a tough one.
That's a tough one. I always tell people, certainly if you know what your GERD, if you're pretty used to your GERD pain is the same all the time, and you get a pain that presents a little bit that differently, then it's probably not your GERD. That's kind of the simple answer. I think the other thing is, and I'm sure if you've had a history of GERD, you've probably have had tests to rule out any cause of your GERD, any heart disease caused.
Yes, I go to my cardiologist, and he says my heart is fine. I have a little bit of heart disease, but it's just, you know, right now I ate lunch an hour and a half ago. Now my stomach is empty, and I got GERD.
Yeah, but what about esophageal problems? Those, I hate to be a tough guy here, but I have it. And I know it. It's not my heart. It's my esophagus that I worry about.
Yeah. Well, it's humbling.
Right.
I think,
what happens that day that I do have a heart attack? I'm going to think it's GERD.
Well, the question that Dr. Wilson and I always ask, well, is this pain different from your GERD pain? Is this,
okay. Is it going to be more intense, a heart attack?
The presentation. Well, everybody has different symptoms of heart attack. You know, one person can have tightness, squeezing. One person can have upper arm pain, chest pain. There's really not one size fits all. But if your GERD pain is pretty consistent and all of a sudden you get a pain that's completely different than that, it's time to beware, you know. And certainly when you have associated symptoms like nausea, vomiting, sweating, you know, not feeling well, shortness of breath, those are clearly heart attack symptoms. But you know, there's not one size that fits all.
Bob, thank you for your call. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Anna Maria in North Adams. Okay, go.
Thank you for taking my call. It's a great program. I've gone on the merry-go-round of emergency room and hospitalization with both of my parents at different facilities in the region. And I always wonder about continuity of care. Patients come into the emergency room, you treat them, they get admitted to the hospital, they stay there for X amount of time, then they're discharged. Do you both feel like we're doing enough to ensure continuity of care for folks, or is there more that we can be doing?
In other words, once they get out of your place, are they being followed up with other physicians?
Well, I know with respect to, you know, our mission as a hospital is really to take care of community. So what we've done is our hospital started to employ physicians. And we have a wide primary care base where we can refer patients to the hospital. If in the private sector, if there's doctors out there with full practices, we try to certainly help them bring in new doctors. But what we've done is we've actually taken a step further. We employ lots of docs, lots of primary care, because they're so needed. So when someone leaves our institution, we try to refer them to one of their primary care physicians that that clearly has capacity that in the community. So I think your hospital really, you know, that's something that, you know, that probably should really be on the top of their list to help ensure that when patients leave the hospital, there's providers out there to take care of them.
Yeah, Anna Maria, this is Andrew Wilson. It's humbling seeing your parents go through the system. I know I've been there myself, and I'll tell you, it is hard. You get the ED doc, the emergency department doc, and then you have the hospitalist, whoever admits the patient, and then they're off to rehab or back home, and then there's a little void there sometimes. But Dr. Sabia had just mentioned, you know, and he's the vice president of the hospital, but, you know, one other thing that they've done at our hospital is really beef up our case management. And, you know, a lot of times we have a bigger safety net now so that if a specialist is needed after a discharge from the hospital, or if they don't have a primary care, or better yet, they more need a geriatrician instead, you know, somebody that specializes, they do have outlets. They contact, they get the appointments made, and they have follow-up. But it's tough. I agree. And medicine has changed. It's not like it was 25 years ago when the same doc you go to just admits you to the hospital. It's very different.
Right.
Anna Maria, thank you so much for your call. Very important question. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Bill in Glens Falls. Okay, Bill, you're on.
Hi, thanks. I worked in ER for years, and I was wondering if the doctors think that the number of diagnostic exams that are done on people is closely monitored enough. And the reason I ask is because all of the ERs that I worked in had what we called frequent flyers, people that were either drug seekers or hypochondriacs. But since you can't ignore their symptoms and assume that, many people, it seemed to me and the people that I worked with, got a lot of x-rays, and we wondered whether or not that was given enough attention. I mean, one individual came in and in the course of a year had we looked and had gotten in just chest CTs alone, had gotten 28 chest CTs.
So you're saying, just for everybody out there listening, a CT is a CAT scan of the chest and x-rays. And, you know, Bill, I'll tell you, you know, being an ER doc and you working in the field, you know that there are some repeat customers. But the thing is, I'll tell you, it's a tough one. I mean, it's a tough one because, you know, if you don't take their symptoms every time just as serious, you will do wrong. And so there's that fine line, especially if you haven't seen that patient in 6 months, but, you know, 13 other ER docs has seen that patient, and you yourself aren't familiar with that patient, but you see that history in the medical record. It's very tough. I go in, I have a very high suspicion of alert on these patients because sometimes they do fall through the cracks because of that reason. And unfortunately, you know, part of that is sometimes they do get over-imaged. But I guess I look at the flip side of I'd hate to miss something, you know, personally and do that patient no justice in downplaying their symptoms when maybe this is the time that they really are having a true entity or a problem.
Put another way, even hypochondriacs get sick every once in a while.
Well, we always felt that it was kind of, from the doctor's standpoint, kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't, sort of.
Well, Bill, let me just comment. You know, I still think there's some opportunity here. So, you know, I certainly understand what you're saying. I think the whole field of emergency medicine learned a lot about pediatric CAT scans, doing CAT scans in the pediatric population.
Correct.
It's not a reflex to do a CAT scan on a three-year-old who bumped his head. And I think we were practicing that way. But now, you know, clearly the literature now is saying, you know, that's a heavy dose of radiation for a child, especially if he's thinking about doing a CAT scan in a child's abdomen to rule out appendicitis. So we've took a hard look at that. We've actually, our CAT scanners now had radiation dose modulation. We give less dose to pediatric patients, so it's a safer situation. So, you know, absolutely, there's no question things like that have really changed things for us and allowed us to take a look at this in a different way.
And this is Andrew Wilson again, but, you know, the other thing we also do in our department is we look at what's called utilization review. So every physician or practitioner, whether it's a physician assistant, nurse practitioner, or physician, we look every month at who's ordering what on patients to make sure that there's no big outliers of excessive testing, you know, just outside of the norm. So, yeah, we're very cognizant of this. This is an excellent question, by the way.
Thank you very much, Bill. Appreciate it. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. Two people on the phone, three free phones. You know you can do the math. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Bruce in Ulster. Okay, Bruce, you're on.
Good afternoon. Good to be able to talk with you this new year with Ebola emerging during the flu season. I have a what-if question. What can happen if somebody who has Ebola but hasn't been diagnosed but feels the symptoms, they're in an emergency room, at the same time as somebody has a roaring case of flu? Can the two merge?
I think that's highly unlikely. Ebola is not an airborne disease. So
I know that.
Yeah, where flu is, I think, you know, we know flu is. So you're saying the strains would interact? Is that what your question?
Yeah,
or the patients could? I'm certainly not an ID physician, but I think something like that happening is very unlikely.
Very unlikely, yeah.
Suppose they're both from the same house and the Ebola person has had contact with the flu person and the flu person has had contact with, you know, some of the fluids of the Ebola person. What can happen then?
Well, there's no question. I think the flu is highly contagious, so the Ebola patient could probably get the flu. That doesn't mean, I mean, I'm a good example. I take care of lots and lots of emergency room patients. I never get the flu. I'm just one of those lucky guys, I guess. Get the flu shot. But
you know what
never
you just did to yourself, don't
what
you?
What I do, I jinx myself.
Yeah.
Ebola, as there's been a lot of hype Ebola being that contagious. It would, you know, it's not as contagious as people think. It would have to be a high concentration of fluids of a highly infected patient, you know, body fluids such as blood, diarrhea, or vomit. So even the transmission of household contacts is unlikely. But, you know, like I said, I don't know if the viruses would interact, mutate. I think the chance of that happening is highly unlikely.
Bruce, thank you very much. Let's go to Kate in, Kate, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. perfect day to listen to this program. My question is this. My husband has Crohn's disease and has for the last 50 years, and there have been a lot of complications because of this disease. And back in August, he had a sigmoidoscopy the day before, and the following day, he ended up with excruciating pain down in his gut. So we went to the emergency room. Are you there?
Yes, yes
sure.
We're here.
Oh, I can't hear you.
You can hear me now? Uh-oh, that phone wasn't good. All right, hello, hello, hello. Goodbye, goodbye. Okay, so what else can I do? I can't, you know, can't hear us. Okay, let's go to Dana in LaGrange, New York. Maybe Kate will call back. We don't know. Dana, you're on.
Hi, Alan.
Yes.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My 16-year-old son recently had an EKG, and the results came back, and his doctor told me that he has a right incomplete bundle branch block. Now, I understand that these physicians aren't cardiologists. At least I don't think they are. I came in late. But I wondered if they knew anything about this. I have an appointment, but I didn't get it for a month with the cardiologist, and I just wondered if they could explain what it is and should I be concerned.
Well, Dan, it's Dr. Sabia. The good news is many times these incomplete right bundle branch blocks occur in people with healthy hearts.
Correct.
Yeah. You know, certainly. Right.
And what are they, Doc?
You know, it's kind of a minor electrical abnormality in the heart, the way the heart conducts its impulses. But I'm not going to even call it an abnormality, because a lot of times it really, you know, on paper it looks this way, but it means you still have a healthy heart. Yeah. So, I mean, to go the distance with the cardiologist and maybe something called an echocardiogram, that probably all makes sense, just to make sure it's nothing more. I think it's unlikely it's going to be anything more than that.
Can I ask, what was the reason he got the EKG? Was he having any symptoms of anything?
No symptoms. It was he was having a Lyme consultation. And the doctor wanted him to have an EKG before putting him on a certain medication.
Good, that's a good doctor right there. Okay, because you can have Lyme disease can actually affect the conduction of the heart. This is Dr. Wilson, by the way. I know there's two of us here today. It's hard to tell us apart.
And I've asked them to identify themselves so we don't confuse them. Yeah.
It's all good.
If it's bad advice, then I'm Dr. Sabia.
So yeah, there you go.
just to let you know that the incomplete right bundle branch block really is, the electricity of the heart. Tells the mechanical part of the heart when to beat a lot of times. And all we're talking about is a slight delay in that electricity getting from one part to the other. And we're talking a 0.1 millisecond qualifies for an incomplete right bundle branch block. Now, whether that's trivial or it means something, you definitely have to talk to your cardiologist about that. Okay. But most of the time, it's okay.
Okay, Dana, I'm so sorry. We're really coming out of time here. I appreciate your call. Let's go back to Kate. Kate, you were telling us about Crohn's disease. Now what?
Right. Okay, what happened was my husband went in for a sigmoidoscopy this summer, and the very next day he ended up with this huge bump coming out of his groin area, or lower intestinal area. We went to the emergency room. Turns out that he had an incarcerated inguinal hernia. But my fear was, and we went into he went into surgery that evening. My fear was that he has a lot of medication that he takes. He's had many surgeries, and I was panicked, worried about the fact that they didn't know all of his history before he was going in to have the surgery.
Boy, I mean, we certainly can feel for you. This is a really, really tough illness, Crohn's disease. We take care of lots and lots of folks in the ED, but certainly the experts caring for your husband, always look at medications and medication interactions, stop or start. We currently have lots of technology now from an imaging point of view to tell if it's a blockage or an infection. So I think putting the faith in the folks taking care of you will get you where you want to go. But and there's lots of new treatment modalities with these intravenous medications they use
or intramuscular. They have all the TNF alpha inhibitors and all these new kind of generation medications. They do have some side effects, but I have a family member too with Crohn's, and I've seen him go through, he was a late diagnosis, and I've seen him go through multiple complications. And it's like I said in the beginning of the show, it's just so humbling to watch something like this. But have him stay the course. I do think the gastroenterologists, that do this day in and day out. I mean, they know this. They know how to treat, and I would definitely, you know, trust them with the guidance.
Kate, thanks for calling back. Appreciate it a lot. We are out of time. I want to apologize to David on the road and Ruth in Ballston Spa. We're not going to be able to get to your calls today, and we are out of time. I want to thank Dr. Andrew Wilson and Dr. John Sabia for joining us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Toprasin for Children, developed for children's pain relief, first aid, and bug bites. Supporting the Ryan McElroy Children's Cancer Foundation, Toprasin.com. Thanks to our engineer, the always incredible Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC.org/VoxPop. You can always hear the program again later in the day on WAMC.org. Stay tuned now for a news update.